There's a newspaper in Israel, one of the most popular daily newspapers, that's called Haaretz. They have a Hebrew edition, they have an English edition. Haaretz is a very left-wing publication. They are politically to the left. They are religiously, I would say, non-existent, not even to the left. They have an axe to grind against those who are on the political right. They have an axe to grind against those who are identified as religious. In the beginning of this millennium, so they employed as editor-in-chief of their newspaper a fellow by the name of David Landau. David Landau passed away a few years ago, and he served as the editor of Haaretz for about 15 years ago, until shortly before he passed away, around 2014, 2015. David Landau was an unusual choice to be editor of Haaretz for two reasons. The first reason was that he was an Anglo. He grew up in London, he grew up in the UK, and Israelis, especially proud ones, this is something they don't always tell you on the Aliyah videos and in Nefesh B'Nefesh promotional materials, Israelis, like any proud society, are a little bit wary of immigrants, and they're not always overjoyed about letting people from the outside into the club. Okay. The other thing is that David Landau was a reformed Orthodox Jew. He spent some time here in Bnei Brak when he was a teenager, attending the Slobodka Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. He spent some time after that in the Hebron Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, two of the most ultra-Orthodox Haredi institutions in the world. After he finished his time in Yeshiva, he decided that organized religion wasn't really for him, and he became a relatively typical secular Jew. But the fact that he even had that background and that upbringing made it a very unusual choice for him to serve as editor-in-chief of a newspaper like Haaretz. On the day that he was appointed to be the editor-in-the-chief, or the week he was appointed as editor-in-the-chief, they ran a series of articles in the newspaper about him and about his history and about his life. And the article and the essays and the question and answer pieces that they published were all about bashing the places that he had come from. I may be from the UK, but nowhere is like Israel. We could probably live with that one. I may have once been religious, but now I have seen the light, and now society is so much better. They wouldn't stop trying to get the money quote. They wouldn't stop because they're good journalists, and like I said, they have a little bit of an agenda. They wouldn't stop trying to get him to really unload on all the reasons why he had rejected this past of being from the UK, and this past especially of having once been an ultra-Orthodox Jew before he saw the light. And in an effort to get him to give one more shot and one more hit and one more negative comment about the backwards ways of the Orthodox Jews that he had grown up with, they said to him, "Is there anything at all that you miss about the time you spent as being an Orthodox Jew? Is there anything at all that you wish you hadn't given up? So now you're able to eat whatever you want, and now you're able to sleep with whomever you want, and now you're able to wake up whenever you want. We know that that's good. We know that you're excited about that. We know that you're one of us, and we know you're all. Is there anything out there in that world, that dark and mysterious world of Orthodox religion, is there anything that you miss at all?" And they were surprised by the answer. I'll give them credit that they published it anyway. But he said, in a way that had a tremendous amount of thoughtfulness, of reminiscing, of nostalgia, he said, "It's funny that you should ask, because the answer is yes. For all that I have rejected, for all that I have given up, for all that I have determined was not for me and not true and not the path that I want to follow, there is one thing that I miss almost every day of my life. It's not his grandmother's chicken soup or a warm challah out of the oven on a Friday night. It's not even the sweet sound of Zmiros or I don't know, anything else that we would associate with great joy and happiness in our religious experiences." He simply said the following. I remember dancing with Jews on a Yom Tov night. I remember the look on people's face when they walked out of a Beis Medrash. Those were the happiest people I have ever encountered. Those were people who had figured something out. I don't know what it was that they figured out. I don't know what it was that made them so happy. But I have been on the hunt. I have been looking in every place I have gone, in every bar and in every university, in every beach and in every vacation spot. I have been looking and checking, peeking under the hood, trying to find out if there is another place in the world where people are as content, people are as happy, people are as fulfilled as they were in those nights on a Sukkot at a Simchas Beis HaShoeva, midnight walking out of the Beis Medrash after having learned or heard a phenomenal shiur. If those people exist that are as happy as those ultra-Orthodox Jews that I left behind, I have yet to meet them. I haven't seen them anywhere else in the world. It's really a good deal of pressure and a great opportunity for me that I am grateful for to be able to kind of kick off the discussion and the Leil Iyun that we're going to have tonight and the follow-up that we're going to have tomorrow morning. This is such an important topic, and it is so critical that we at least lay the groundwork for the discussion right now over the next few minutes in this opening session that has a somewhat ambiguous title that I will explain to you what it's about right now. But first I'll explain to you what is not included in the title and what is the prerequisite for our having a productive experience over the next few minutes in this room and over the rest of the evening and tomorrow and all of the other shiurim and discussions that you choose to participate in. That is that we are real, that we are honest, that we are thoughtful about what we are going to discuss and what we are going to consider. Our challenge over the next few minutes is for us to be able to discuss a little bit of the whys of what a person is looking for, why a person might succumb to any variety of otherwise self-destructive behaviors, to get involved in things. What are we looking for? How are we making these decisions? What are we pursuing? What is our goal and what is our intent? And I'm going to suggest to you that very often we misdiagnose exactly what it is we're looking for and why we are there. And I'm going to try in the time that we have to make three very simple points for your consideration and for your brutally honest review. To think how much, if any of this resonates with you, how much of this applies to feelings and thoughts, temptations and desires you've had in your life. The temptations and desires we're talking about right now are not the normal, healthy, red-blooded male desires when it comes to areas of sexuality or that kind of desire. I'm talking about more emotional needs, more psychological needs that I strongly believe have universal application to virtually everybody sitting here right now. Number one is David Landau. We want to be happy. We want to live a life in which we feel good about ourselves and the things that we are doing. A different time we can talk about whether or not that is the ideal, whether or not the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is a Torah ideal, is what we are supposed to do. On the one hand, we know that the Mesilas Yesharim writes, as so many of you undoubtedly have learned, that a person's ability to pursue pleasure in this world and to extract happiness and joy in this world is a prerequisite for any successful existence in all of Avodas Hashem. Long before the Ramchal said it in the Mesilas Yesharim. The Torah said it in the Tochacha of Parshas Kisavo. A person gets punished if they opt to serve God without a sense of simcha and joy, no question about it. We sing and we know, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, one should always serve with a sense of joy, no question about it. The Gemara in Brachos tells us, as many of us will learn this summer, that a person cannot daven to Hashem unless they feel a certain sense of inner joy and happiness and peace of mind. So there's no doubt that there is a logic to, a justification for the pursuit of happiness. It could well be, and again, a discussion for a different time, we don't have time for it right now, it could well be that that goal is not the end-all and be-all of Torah society and living. It could be that it is, I don't want to say overrated, but perhaps overemphasized. The goal of life is not to be happy. It's not what the Ramchal said. It's not what the Torah said. Happiness is a tool, and happiness is a means, maybe the healthier approach. But it doesn't matter for tonight. What matters for tonight is that we are all pursuing happiness. I could tell you that that's bad. I could tell you that we should be martyrs. I could tell you that we should take a page out of the Holocaust or the Inquisition. That if there's such a statement that was common in the Depression era and the last century in America, is schwer zu sein a Yid. It's lousy to be a Jew. Welcome to lousiness. Welcome to misery. You come to NCSY Kollel, you're going to be unhappy. Because Judaism makes you unhappy. I could tell you all that stuff. And it wouldn't change the fact that we are all pursuing happiness. We may well be pursuing it in the wrong places. You must, for our first point of the evening, you must remember the story of David Landau. If you do a drop of reverse engineering, if you look at the people in your life, in your family, in your community, if the people who seem the most well-adjusted, the people who seem to have it the most figured out, and the bottom line is, the people in your life that seem to you to be the most happy are the people who are addicted to marijuana, are the people who have a drug habit, are the people who are watching pornography almost endlessly every single night, are the people who don't pick their heads up from their phones in a minute, then I would tell you, just for the purposes of right now, there's what to talk about. You'd have to at least consider, I'll have a little bit of that. Maybe that's a good idea for me. But I would suggest to you, and this is where the honesty comes in, you know a lot of people. Everybody does. Don't have to be your friends. Don't have to be people that you know every intimate detail about. Just take a poll of the people around you that seem to have it figured out, that seem to have that extra step in their lives, that seem to be a little bit more joyful, a little bit more content, and a little bit more happy. And ask yourself, what are they doing to get there? Are they getting there because they're high? Are they getting there because that happiness can only be attained if you're drinking Jack Daniels from your parents' liquor cabinet on a 3 times a week basis? I don't think so. I don't think there are too many people in this room who will find that ever. We'll talk about the coolest people you know in a moment, because we're going to be brutally honest. But if we were to make decisions just on what is likely to make us happy, likely to make us understand, likely to give us the lives we want to lead, we would probably come to the conclusion that various behaviors, and let's use as an example something as innocuous as telephone use. The more that I use my iPhone, does it make me happier or not? Everybody in the world speaks about how the most efficient device in the history of the universe makes us so much less efficient. I don't need to belabor that point. I was not given the task about speaking about technology for our entire session here this evening. I'll ask you a paraphrase version, as I just did, of that question. Does another 20 minutes on my phone ever make me happy? Does getting to, I don't know, don't respond to this one too quickly, but does solving a level or getting a kill or winning Fortnite, does it actually make me happy? Do I have a better day the next day? You could ask the same thing, by the way, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. You could ask the same thing about sports obsession. Yankees have a tough loss. The Giants trade OBJ. My life tangibly different the next day. Am I actually a happier, more insightful, more productive person because of any of that? I don't think there are too many people in this room who would say yes. And it's easy to pick on sports obsession. Use just the technology. Let's leave out everything else from tonight's discussion for a minute. Just the way we do that. If I were to control the use of my phone, be a little bit smarter, just one question, would I be happier? And if the answer to that question is, of course I would be. Of course, the root of so much of my misery is my obsession and my compulsion to check my phone for messages and for news and for fantasy football every 3 seconds, and none of it makes me happy. If the answer is, of course, then what are we doing? There's a book some of you may have gotten here for Bar Mitzvah. It was written by a friend and a neighbor of mine who's quite the celebrity in Israel these days, speaking about people from outside the country who made good. His name is Rabbi Dov Lipman. He's an Oleh from Maryland. He taught in a lot of places, including Reshit, where he was a colleague of mine, and he became a Chaver Knesset, a member of Knesset. There is not a very large club of Americans who became Chavre Knesset. He's also a passionate sports fan. He wrote a book specifically designed for Bar Mitzvah boys, and again, some of you probably have it on your shelf. I don't know if you opened it or not. It's called Time Out. Torah Lessons from the World of Sports, or something like that, is the subtitle of Rabbi Dov Lipman's book. It's okay. It's a good book. It's a nice recommendation. Michael Rose probably sells it. He's the fellow who comes by at lunch sometimes. You can buy it. It's a paperback. It's not that much money. And if you like sports and you want to grow a little bit, he's got a whole bunch of really nice analogies there. There is one paragraph that he has that, for my recommendation, from my perspective, makes the book completely worth the price of admission. Makes it worth it to buy it just to read this paragraph, just to read this essay, just to read this chapter. He speaks about a fellow that many of you have heard of and many others of you have not, by the name of Len Bias. Len Bias, and there's a legend of Len Bias, which is not the same as the truth of Len Bias. Len Bias was a really, really good college basketball player. They say he was the next Jordan. That's not true. They say he was going to be the greatest ever, or that he was the greatest college player ever. That's not true. He had an All-American career at Maryland, and he was the number two pick in the 86 or 87 draft in the NBA. He was great, no question about it. Number two pick in the draft is not too shabby. Not only was he the number two pick in the draft, but there's a legendary GM for the Boston Celtics by the name of Red Auerbach. Red Auerbach orchestrated in the last great move that he made that the world champion Boston Celtics ended up with the number two pick in the draft. Commissioner's nightmare. Parity's enemy. Somehow Red Auerbach didn't just have the best basketball team with Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, and those Celtics, but he also was smarter as a GM than everybody else, so the best team in the league ended up with the number two pick. And Len Bias, as Larry Bird's back began to give out, Len Bias was the heir apparent to the Celtics dynasty. Except it never happened. On the day that Len Bias, shortly after being drafted, signed his tens of millions of dollar contract with the Boston Celtics, he OD'd on cocaine. I don't think there are a lot of people here who are going to OD on cocaine. I'm not here to tell you a story about cocaine and the horrors of cocaine or anything else like that. He OD'd on cocaine. It was the biggest sports drug story, arguably, of all time, and there have been many sports drug stories. But the biggest sports drug tragedy of all time. Prime of his life, healthy athlete, goes to a party on his home campus in Maryland in College Park, ODs on cocaine, and it's over. The tragedy of such potential being cut. And it was a tragedy. Not a Celtics fan, not a University of Maryland fan, never loved Len Bias, but it depressed the heck out of me when I was 13 years old in 1986. Very, very sad, sad incident when, again, such greatness and such potential isn't realized because of it. That's not what I'm telling you the story for. In Rabbi Dov Lipman's book, he asks the following question. What and why was Len Bias looking for when he snorted cocaine and killed himself, not purposely, that night? Could you have a bigger high than his life? What is the high that's the next level that you're looking for? What else is there? You just got drafted by the best team in the NBA and literally handed a check for more money than you've ever seen or imagined in your entire life. Life could not be better. But Len Bias said, you know what? I think I want a little more happiness. think I get a little bit higher right now. He snorts cocaine. Why do we do the things that we do? And Rabbi Libman suggests in the most simple and humble of ways, he knows exactly what Len Bias was doing. Len Bias was not happy. Len Bias was looking in the wrong places for happiness, and ironically, it's the reverse of Len Bias that gets recreated in yeshiva high school hallways, behind the building and camp, on winter vacations in Florida, all of the time. I'm not finding happiness where it is. Maybe I'll find it somewhere else. Maybe I'll find happiness with this device, with this vice, with this temptation, or in this area. I just want to be happy, and that's what I'm looking for in these situations. And before we make such a dangerous calculation, we have to ask ourselves about the odds of success. Is it going to give us what we're looking for? Is it going to give us peace of mind? Is it going to give us insight and understanding? Is it going to give us happiness or not? Number two. The other thing, and here's where we're going to dig a little bit deeper into a really honest place, I hope, and you'll forgive me if anything I say comes out as insulting in any way, because I have so much respect, as Rabbi Leshack described this morning, as this group being his heroes. I couldn't agree more with that. I don't mean this in a negative way. I mean this in the most positive way possible. I look up to everybody who is fighting this battle. In so many ways, more than I look up to the people who are just chasing happiness. Because at the end of the day, as we said before, just chasing happiness is not necessarily what it's all about. You know what it's all about? It's about a level of self-actualization and fulfillment that makes us be the best versions of ourselves possible. I am way done recruiting for NCSY Colo 2019. But if I had to tell you what I believe is the most basic, important, and attractive characteristic of this program is that it takes heroic and wonderful young men like the one sitting in this room right now, and it makes them nothing but the best versions of themselves possible. You are familiar undoubtedly with the Gemara in Maseches Pesachim that describes the way Rabbi Yossi would have a special party on Shavuos. And that special party in Shavuos, he would say, when his Talmidim asked him, what are you so excited? I get it, you like Torah. What are you so excited about on Shavuos? And Rabbi Yossi would respond, if it were not for that day, if it were not for that summer, if it were not for that Thursday night, Kama Yossi Ika Bishuka. How many other Yossis would there be in the street? I would be almost literally, the name Yossi is the same name as Yosef or Joseph or Joe. How many other ordinary, I'd just be another plain Joe. I would just be Kama Yossi Ika Bishuka. I'd just be another Josie. I would just be another Joe. And now because of Torah, I'm something special. Many of the Bali Musar point out, and if there's an idea that resonates for summer 2019, I am sure that it is this one. Many point out, he's not referring to all the people in the market named Josie. He's not referring to all the people that he would have been just like. He is referring to the multiple versions of himself that could have been, that would have been, and in fact that were. We all have multiple versions of ourselves. Doesn't make us schizophrenic, even in the incorrect usage of that term. It doesn't make us personality disorder people. No, not at all. Doesn't even make us hypocrites. We grow up in a world that is so fractured, that involves so many different influences, that every single one of us has multiple versions of ourselves. And we need to figure out what the best version of ourselves is. Not necessarily the happiest, although again, it's connected, and we spoke about that already. Simply the best version of ourselves. What is going to get me to the best version of myself? Let's pick on Fortnite again for just a moment. Forget about how happy it makes you, because I respect and understand that there may be a minority of people in this room who are genuinely elated when they win a game of Fortnite. Genuinely elated when the Giants win the Super Bowl. They are actually happy the next day and the day after. I'm not saying it makes sense, not saying it's everybody, but it could be. I want to know if there's anybody who, after playing Fortnite for an entire Sunday afternoon, feels like the best version of themselves. Feels like they have accomplished, feels a sense of fulfillment, feels a sense of self-development and actualization that makes them proud, and yes, that word again, makes them happy. You are familiar with, undoubtedly, the fact that the way in which Chazal, our rabbis in the Gemara and elsewhere, refer to tefillah is by referring to it with the exceptionally bizarre name of Amida, the Amida. If you have an old Siddur, it says when it translates what davening is or what Shemona Esrei is. Shemona Esrei is also a fairly lousy name, by the way. The 18, and it's not even 18, it's 19. Ever think about how bad the names are for Shemona Esrei? They're absolutely terrible. Shemona Esrei is not good, and Amida is 10 times worse. The Amida? The standing? Imagine having to explain what we do 3 times a day to a person who has never walked into a shul before. Okay, now what are we going to do? Well, we get up to Shema, now we are going to listen. Oh, that's awesome, actually. That's pretty good, even though we never do it. We're going to now cover our eyes. Okay, that's kind of mystical, and I could see where that would be exciting, perhaps also. We're going to have Kabbalah's Ol Malchus Shemayim. That makes sense. We're going to read some verses. We're going to have some poetry readings. Again, could be, maybe not your thing, but at least it makes sense. Now what are we doing? Now we're standing. What does that mean? Why do we call it the stand? I mean, isn't it prayer? Isn't prayer have a lot more cooler and better definitions than just standing? So again, for a different time, I'll share with you multiple possible answers to that question. Some that I believe in even more than the very simple one that I'm going to suggest to you over the next 60 seconds. But I want you to hear the simple one that I'm going to suggest to you over the next 60 seconds. You know what you do when you daven? You become the best version of yourself. You actually stand up and develop an identity that isn't cowering in fear or in shame, but is proud, strong, and tall. Amida is called Amida because the most important result of proper tefillah is not that all my wishes get answered. It's not that my relative gets healthy, or that I pass the test, or my girlfriend agrees to go out with me. None of those things. Not that all of my bakashos, whatever they may be, get answered. The most important value and accomplishment, the most important thing we get out of tefillah, is that we stand tall. Is that we take 3 steps back and we reflect on the fact that the very best version of ourselves was just standing in that shul, was just standing in that base medrash. And with all vice and temptation, with all of these things, there is such an enormous sacrifice of that best version of ourselves. And I issue you the same exact challenge that you have to answer better. If you feel when you are high, if you feel when you are drooling, if you feel when you're playing Fortnite, and I'm not equating all of those things, and I'm not suggesting they all universally apply. If you feel when you watch 9 hours of football on a Sunday afternoon without a break, if you feel like you've met the best version of yourselves, it's hard for me to tell you not to do it. If alcohol brings out the very best in you, and I've met a couple of people for whom that's true, we need to move to a different discussion to explain why alcohol might yet be problematic. But for 99% of this room, probably 100%, and 99% of every person I've ever met, it's simply not true. It's a lousy version of ourselves. A very wise man, and this is not his own invention, I'm sure many of you have heard this before, we ask often, and you should get answer tonight, what's the big deal about Julie? What's the big deal about marijuana? What's the big deal about smoking? And each of those can have all of their own answers. But a very wise man, a long time ago, suggested to me that the biggest problem with all of those things is not the things themselves. They may or may not, in the case of cigarettes, the jury is in on that one, gentlemen. They may or may not kill you. They may or may not be a gateway to a million and one other things. You know what their biggest problem may be? In big, this point about which version of ourselves emerges from that hot box. Which version of ourselves emerges from that high? The best or the worst? The proudest or the most ashamed? The biggest or the smallest? And in specific, because we owe it ourselves to be specific, this individual told me many, many years ago, anything that has you meeting with the sketchiest guy in town behind the tree at 2 o'clock in the morning and then spraying like deodorant on your jacket so you don't reek of smoke when you come home, that itself is the problem. It's not a symptom of the problem. It's not evidence of the crime. Who am I? Who am I hanging out with? What is my life centered around? What version of myself does that? The version that is filled with a sense of accomplishment that I negotiated a good deal? The version of myself that is thrilled to tears that I got away with something from my parents or my principal? Is that an Amida moment? Is that a standing tall moment? Or is that a moment of shame, of fear, of smallness that we want to just get rid of all of the time? Sometimes for theological reasons, sometimes for practical reasons, we must make ourselves small. Many of you went on the extension on one of the Hari Eilat hike, if you were on one of the buses that went down around by the coast, and then went up. So in the extension of the hike, there's a place in that hike, many of you will remember it, where the path is completely blocked, and it looks like it's really impossible to get through. And Yair Zakai and other big guys are like, it's just not possible. And the human body, there are Japanese game shows that do this. The human body has an amazing ability to contort itself and to provide itself with the smallest possible form that it can do. And if you're going on a hike in a lot, and you need to get past a giant boulder and catch up with the rest of the group, that's a really good skill to come in handy. And if you're going to bow down in front of God and make yourself small in front of the awesomeness of God, it's a really good skill to come in handy. But if your entire life is about making yourself small, if you don't recognize that in the hills of Eilat, and much more importantly, when we are bowing down in tefillah, we are accomplishing what one of my Rebbeim, Rav Blachman, who will be here next week, has often described as greatness through smallness. If we are not actually making ourselves the best versions of ourselves, then what are we doing? Point number one, what is actually making us happy? Point number two, what is actually making us great? What is providing us with the best version of ourselves, the greatest sense of self-fulfillment, the greatest sense of self-actualization? What are the things that leads to that? And what are the things that leads us to the dead end of smallness? And point number three. And here we'll go on a very, very divergent track that I think is critically important for absolutely everyone to understand in this generation more than any other that has ever lived before. I will posit to you that we are more susceptible to temptation, we are more susceptible to addiction, we are more susceptible to vice than any people who have ever lived before. And Rabbi Leshak was explicit about it a few hours ago. Anybody who overcomes that, anybody who fights it and battles it, is so much higher and so much greater than generations before that did not struggle with this as much as we struggle with it all of the time. There is a psychologist in Canada by the name of Bruce Alexander. His stuff has been quoted in a number of places. I will tell you very honestly that I am not a scientist, I am not a scholar, and many in the academic community question some of the findings that I'm going to suggest to you right now. This is not something that should be taken as the word of God, and a scientist and a real researcher has to ascertain the extent to which what I'm about to describe to you is true. But that it is true to some extent, I have absolutely no doubt about. and that it is relevant to all of us in this room, I have absolutely no doubt about. Bruce Alexander was quoted by a thinker and a writer and author of a best-selling book on this topic by the name of Johann Harry. Johann Harry, H-A-R-I. Johann Harry has a TED Talk with well over 3 million views to its credit. It is worthwhile to watch his entire 11-minute TED Talk, even though the science behind it, and again, I'm being very clear with you, if you Google it for 2 seconds, you will find out that the science behind what he describes is questionable. But not questionable because the whole thing is nonsense or made up. Only a question of degree, only a question of how right he is. Johann Harry, in quoting the works of Bruce Alexander, his TED Talk is entitled, "Everything We Think We Know About Addiction Is Wrong." And he suggests that the number one cause for susceptibility towards addiction is not biological, is not physiological, it's none of those things. It is, to use a word that will be slightly misleading before we explain it fully, it is actually, he says, contextual. It is about environment, but not in the way before you roll your eyes, not in the way you think. Not peer pressure environment at all. Listen to Bruce Alexander's findings and listen to his explanations. For years, we have been taught, and many have been told, that if drugs of a powerful nature, and we're using that as an example, not because people are into heavy drugs, that's not our topic for tonight, really, but if opioids, if heroin, if morphine in a hospital is introduced in a system, if you're not very careful, addiction will follow. In the 1970s, when Bruce Alexander did his research, he observed something that many in the scientific community observed. When American soldiers without drug addictions went off to Vietnam, they acquired a drug habit at staggering rates. Half the soldiers, I'm exaggerating and being non-precise when I use the word half, but a great number of soldiers in Vietnam were high almost all of the time. Based on the prevailing wisdom, the assumption was that at the end of the Vietnam War, those who were lucky enough to have survived to return home to their communities and families would do so as hardcore drug addicts. Because once it's in your system, and once you have the addiction, there's nothing you can do about it. And Bruce Alexander and others were shocked to discover that the rate of addiction when people returned back to their homes and communities went back to pre-war levels, more or less. People had no problem breaking an addiction when they were in a completely different context. No problem at all. And then he ran one of the most famous psychological experiments of all time. It's called the Rat Park Experiment. There's a rat in a cage. There are two sources of water. One is pure water and one is laced with drugs. When a rat is in a cage with those two options, it sooner or later starts to experience the drugs, likes what it feels. Rats don't have to worry about eternal happiness or self-fulfillment. It just feels really good to be high, at least in that moment. And the rats almost invariably develop high levels of drug addiction. So drugs, when introduced to a person, whether that drug is an actual drug or opioid, or whether that drug is another form of distraction or vice, like internet or pornography or video games or anything else like that, when it's introduced to a system, the opportunity is there, we become addicted. We can't help ourselves from self-destructive behavior. Those drug addict rats died for the most part. But then came the famous part of Alexander's experiment. When he took mice and he gave them alternatives. When he put the mice not in a cage, but in a cage that he famously called Rat Park, where there were other mice to play with and other things to do, the rates of addiction plummeted to an astounding degree. the contextual contribution, the contextual factor in drug addiction, and it's all vice. It applies absolutely to internet usage, to phone usage, to pornography, to all of it. And I'll give you the specifics of it in a minute. The contextual aspects of it are based on the fact that when we have an alternative, and I'll tell you an alternative to what, we are often more capable of making good decisions. I'll make a couple of bold statements because we're short on time, but I want to make sure that we get this last point to its fullest, so I will not beat around the bush at all. Boredom is an amazing contributor to all of the problems that we face in the world of addiction. If we had more to do, we would be addicted less. Furthermore, Alexander and Johann Harry and his things suggest that all human beings, in addition to pursuing happiness, and in addition to pursuing self-fulfillment, what we want above all, and this is our point number three, is connection. We want to be connected to, excited about, almost obsessed, and I'm reluctant to use the word because I'm not a doctor, but almost addicted to something. We want to be connected to someone or something on the most intense level. And if that thing is not something good, positive, and real, then I will fill that void, which is a fundamental human need to fill. I will fill that void with nonsense. There's a reason why post 9/11 people pointed out how many war analogies were used in football. Blitzes and bombs and all sorts of other references to warfare. People said post 9/11, you know, like it's not that appropriate. You know how many sports references have to do with religion? Cathedrals and mentors and heroes, those are all the things of religion. And we use them in sports because when there is a void, when the thing that is supposed to be filling the void in my life is not there, I will fill it with something else almost invariably. The first year that I taught, it's not important where, I taught a group of young men that battled with a number of the things that we're speaking about right now, including some pretty serious drugs. First time in my life that I had a conversation with a student about really, really excessive drug use was an unbelievably wonderful 10th grader who I had a fantastic relationship with, who confided with me about a lot, and I told him, "You're killing yourself. You've got to stop. You've got to break the habit." And after weeks and months of conversation and of pleading, he came to me one day and he said, "I'm going to do it. I'm going to stop. I'm done. This is the end." And I said to him, "Look, I don't know that much about all this stuff. There may be some hard times. This can't be easy. It won't be easy. There may even be physical withdrawal symptoms. Here's my home phone number." There were no cell phones then. "Here's my home's phone number. Call me any time of day or night if you have any problem at all, and we'll talk it through. We'll get you through it." That very night, not at 3 o'clock in the morning, that very night at 9:45 p.m., he calls me, and he is in an absolute panic, complete frenzy. I hear through the phone how agitated and how anxious he is. "Rabbi, it's not working. Rabbi, it's a disaster. Rabbi, I don't know what to do." I'm scrambling because I figure I might have really messed him up. And the truth is, in all seriousness, I did mess him up, as you'll hear in the end of the story. I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what withdrawal is like. I don't know if he's in physical danger. He sounds really distressed. He sounds really concerned. So I start throwing questions at him about his physical state, about his mental state, about his possibility that he's going to inflict harm on himself. He corrects me. He says, "Rabbi, whoa. I'm okay like that. I said, "So what are you so agitated about?" He says, "I don't know what to do. I've never been so bored in my entire life. I've done nothing but smoke weed for the past 18 months of my life. I don't know the last time I had a normal conversation with a person. I don't know the last time that I've watched a television show. I don't know the last time I watched a Knick game. All I do is smoke weed, and I have never been so bored in my entire life." That's the reverse of what I'm describing to you. It's a true story. And I learned an amazing lesson that night, a lesson that has deep relevance to us, even if we're not addicted to drugs. The lesson I learned that night is you cannot create a void if you're trying to solve the problem of having a void. There needs to be replacement value for what we do. A number of years ago, probably close to 15 years ago, was having a conversation with a major Rosh Yeshiva here in Israel, and they said, you know that there is an epidemic in our community of everything we're speaking about tonight. Temptation, addiction, and vice. You know how many people come to Yeshiva and they are addicted to pornography? How many people come to Yeshiva and they are addicted to their, in those times it wasn't phones, it was a computer or something like that. They are, it's like a golf tournament here. They are addicted to whatever, they're addicted to marijuana, addicted to cigarettes. And we've done our research and we've done our homework. You know the only place in the normal high school experience where people seem to have lower, not non-existent, I wouldn't pretend for a minute that it's non-existent. You know what, we speak to so many people, you know what consistently comes up as the place in which there is less of that than anywhere else? And you'll, by the way, call my bluff, tell me I'm wrong, because you know what his answer was, and you know why he was telling it to me. Guy after guy says, you know the 6 weeks of my life where I was doing less of that? NCSY Colo. So he said to me, you got to share the secret. What are you doing? What's in the water? What's in the food? What are you doing? What's your educational method? What are you talking about? What are you saying? Who's giving the speech? We've never done this program before in the history of NCSY Colel. So of course my answer was, I'll tell you later. I had no idea what the answer was until it dawned on me exactly what the answer was. And you know what it is? It's not Rav Schechter and Rav Tversky. It's not the best Rebbeim in the world. It's not even the role models of your incredible Madrichim. You know what the answer is? We're really, really busy here. You have less downtime than you've ever had in your life. We're filling a void that naturally exists for every person. We're filling that void with something greater and more wholesome. When the Jewish people are encamped around Moab and they are enticed by the girls who come to seduce them after Balak fails to curse them. We read this story not long ago. The Torah tells us shortly before they engage in the worst kind of vice and sin. The Torah says, Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim. They stayed in this place where all of it went down, where all of it fell apart. They stayed in this place that was called Shitim. Rashi says right away, it's an unusual Rashi, Kach Shema. You know why they called it Shitim? Because that was its name. Okay, that's a weird Rashi. I mean, why else would you call something Shitim unless that it's its name? But of course, the Sifsei Chachamim points out right away, because I know what you're going to do. You're going to try to tell me that it wasn't really its name and that the word Shitim represents something. And the Sifsei Chachamim is right. And Rashi is right in being worried about that, because the Medrash actually does say exactly that. The Medrash says nobody cares what the name of the city they were in. It was called Shitim, like the Gemara in Maseka Sota says about the word Sota, an adulterous woman. Nichnas Bohem Ruach Shtus. There was something for them that was a foolish spirit. There was an emptiness for them. And the great Bali Musar and the great Jewish psychologist explains, it doesn't mean that they had the wrong hashkafa. It doesn't mean that they weren't learned. It meant that they were bored. It meant that there was a void of value and of meaning. There was a void of self-definition that created the opportunity for vice and temptation to take hold. You know what the best reaction the next time we're tempted is? Not that I'm better than that. Not that I'm smarter than that. Not even that it won't necessarily make me happy or self-fulfilled. I'd love to, but I'm just too busy. I'd love to, but I've got other things that are occupying my time. I don't need to be obsessed about the Giants because I'm obsessed about myself and my position in life. I'm obsessed about helping the world and the Jewish people. I'm obsessed about being great at the things that I do. I just don't have time to worry about that much of anything else. Netflix and blank is a state of mind that we are here. When I'm obsessed with Netflix, it opens up a window. It creates space in my life for all sorts of other stuff. So I should be really careful about what I open up and what types of empty spaces I create in my life. Because if I don't fill all those voids with things of matter, I'm not going to be successful. Last couple of sentences. We have an epidemic when it comes to filling voids. We have an epidemic when it comes to genuine and meaningful connections with people and with things. We are the loneliest generation, the biggest failures, not at God, at connections, that has ever existed in this world. We feel more distant from the world around us than ever before, and we fill that void with self-destructive behaviors and crazy behaviors. The former Surgeon General of the United States, a fellow by the name of Vivek Murthy, wrote an article where he said that loneliness and lack of connectivity has done more health damage to the United States of America population than cigarettes and cancer of all kind have ever done. It literally, according to the Surgeon General of the United States, not a professor of psychology or a Balmusser, a medical doctor, done more physical damage to us than anything else, any other disease you could think of. Loneliness. Do you know that in the United Kingdom, in an effort to save a failing society, there is a ministry of loneliness? I did not make that up. You can Google it in a minute. The United Kingdom looked at their world and they said, we are messed up. We don't know how to connect and we don't know how to fill voids. So we play on our phones and we engage in behaviors that are self-destructive and we numb ourselves because we're not capable of developing the strongest and realest connections that we need to connect in order to function in this world. And we can't make that mistake. If we become better at filling voids, if we become better at connecting, we will have no room and no space and no desire for any of the vices and temptations that we are discussing and speaking about tonight. So I am requesting of you one thing and humbly suggesting to you, to summarize, three ideas. I am suggesting to you that you spend the rest of this night and the rest of this period through tomorrow, and the rest of this summer, being honest and real about the things we're talking about. Why am I tempted? And why do I make the decisions that I do? And let me be honest and reflecting upon myself. And I am suggesting to you that the path to happiness, the path to self-fulfillment and being great and standing tall, and ultimately, the path to healthy, strong living, in which I fill voids and make connections with people and I have real friends and I'm no longer so alone, I'm no longer so disconnected, does not run through marijuana and it does not run through Netflix and it does not run through being the coolest guy in the school and it does not run through nonsense and it does not run through a jewel and it does not run through any of that stuff. It runs through the self-development that allows us to pursue greatness, that allows us to pursue truth, that allows us to make meaningful and real connections. That is what we are all looking for. And Be'ezras Hashem, something that we will be able to find and succeed, that will put the biggest smile and establish for ourselves the best versions of ourselves because of how we fill our time and the connections that we were able to make. I thank you so much for listening. You should please hurry up quickly to the next session of the 20 other time.